Hello, this is Peter Fisher with episode 10 of the General One podcast. This week we'll be talking about timescales. So last week I said I'd talk a little bit about practical things of graduate student life. One thing that came up when I was talking to Alex Hamilton when I was at Columbia was what's really the difference between a graduate student and an undergraduate. And he thought it'd be quite interesting to talk about this. So, you know, I have undergraduates who work with me and graduate students, and typically two or three of each. And when I think of graduate students, what I'm really thinking of are people who are colleagues. That's not to say equals, I mean, in the sense of experience or knowing what's going on, but people who are on the course to become physicists. And I see my job with graduate students as really much more teaching them to be physicists than imparting some specific body of knowledge. Undergraduates are, you know, undergraduates, and my job really with them is to make sure that they graduate and continue on with whatever it is they've chosen to do with their lives. And so the relationship is really very different. Obviously, it's not binary. There are clearly some undergraduates I've worked with who are on a par with graduate students, even senior graduate students, and vice versa. But generally, the feeling I think most of us who are faculty have is that graduate students are really colleagues and are treated and just thought of as much differently than the typical undergraduate. And what does that mean? Well, just as an example, if I give an undergraduate a project, I sort of go and gather papers and documents from my files and collect them together and sit down with them and go over it, you know, very carefully, and then tell them, you know, exactly what's expected and exactly the time scale and so on. And part of this is because undergraduates are typically very busy. They might work with me for 10 hours a week or even less. Graduate students have much more time, although you may not think that. Graduate students typically are going to be in graduate school working with me for 4 or 5 years. And over that time, they're going to do a lot of different things. And so when starting a project with a graduate student, what I typically do is maybe give them one key paper and some notes. And there's the expectation that they're going to go off and, if they don't know about something, learn about it on their own. They're going to look up the original papers or go talk to somebody or ask me. But they're not going to just, you know, kind of sit back and expect to be given a complete project that they just have to execute without, you know, any initiative on their own. And I think that's really the key difference. Because they're colleagues, I expect, and I think most people who are faculty members agree, that there will be some considerable amount of initiative in terms of starting things and sticking with things. That we all know the road of science is very long, and it's really quite hard. Anyway, that's just kind of what I had to say about the advisor-student relationship. In fact, you know, that's a good thing. You have an advisor in graduate school. You don't have a boss, and you should keep that term in mind. So in this podcast, we're going to talk about time scales. We already had a podcast about energy scales. Energy scales are a little bit more cleanly defined by time scales for reasons that aren't immediately obvious. Energy scales are very closely related with distance scales by HBAR-C, and that for some reason isn't really clear to me. Time is actually a very interesting thing, and something that is really, I think, for us in the physical sciences, is not something that we study very much, except, you know, atomic physicists who make atomic clocks and think about frequency standards and things like that. We don't think about the properties and concepts of time so much. There's really kind of the view that it's all that's just subsumed with length into special and general relativity. I'm not really sure it is. I'm teaching a freshman seminar right now that's just on time, and certainly the students in the freshman seminar, who are amazingly well versed in contemporary popular science, having read, you know, the books by Brian Greene and Alan Guth and Weinberg's book, they seem to think, you know, purely in relativistic terms, and I see it more broadly. This is probably not really the place to get into it. So let's just start with time scales, starting with people. People live about 100 years these days. During that time, a typical resting heartbeat is maybe 60, 70 beats per second or per minute. The respiratory rate's about 20 breaths per minute. And those things define the extrema of one's consciousness, that you think and perceive somewhere on a time scale that's longer than your heartbeat but short to your total time on Earth. That's how you, just in the course of your day. So there are a few different ways of approaching time scales. Probably the first is to just think about how a second is defined, which is about 10 trillion periods of the cesium-133 hyperfine transition. So the hyperfine transition is it's like the 21 centimeter transition. It's a spin up, spin down, or spin flip of the valence electron in cesium-133. And that's about a 10 trillionth of a second. And that's used in frequency standards to define the second. As I mentioned in the last podcast, if you want to learn about how all the units are defined relative to each other, I think it's Appendix E of Purcell's book has all of that in it. So that's the definition of a second. And starting from the beginning of the universe, inflation, which you've all probably read about, was long over by 1 second, and the universe was, I think, well into nucleosynthesis, which lasted until about 3 minutes from the start of the Big Bang. The electroweak phase transition, I think, happened at a microsecond or something like that. One thing you should probably know, just because it's so important these days, is that hydrogen atoms formed about 350,000 years after the Big Bang. That's about a Z of 1100, and that was the emission of the microwave background photons. Now you can relate Z to gamma just by remembering that microwaves have sort of centimeter wavelengths or 100 gigahertz frequencies, and that originally those transitions were on the order of a few electron volts. So that gives you that wavelength gives you that change in wavelength gives you a characteristic stretching of the universe that occurred from the end of the Big Bang and now. The time from the Big Bang to now is about, as I recall, 13.8 billion years. The Earth itself is about 5 billion years old. And the galaxy formed, it's not really clear when galaxy formed. It's probably sometime before the Earth and suns formed. So give it, say, order of 6 billion years. These are not specific numbers you should know for the general one, but these are numbers that you should know regardless of your field. Talking a little bit about the galaxy, the Earth is one astronomical unit from the Sun, and an astronomical unit is the Earth-Sun distance, and that's, I always remember 97 million miles and then have to convert, which gives about 150 million kilometers. So the light travel time from the Earth to the Sun is about 8.3 minutes. The light travel time then out to Pluto, which is at 70 AU, and there have been spacecraft that have gone out that far, both Voyagers, for example, is about 70 times that. So that's something like 10 hours light travel time. So the furthest man has gotten away from the Earth with relatively sophisticated spacecraft is about 10 light hours. The nearest star is a couple of light years away. The nearest galaxy, Andromeda, is about two mega light years away. Now, the Earth is in the Milky Way galaxy, and it's about 8.5 kiloparsecs out, which is 76,000 light years, and moving at something like 300-350 kilometers per second, which corresponds to a beta of about 10 to the minus 3. So it takes on the order of 20 million years to complete an orbit. So the Earth has orbited something like 50 times in 10 billion years. So if you guess the galaxy's been around that long, I think it's actually about half that. So 25 orbits around the galaxy. That gives you some sort of scale. And 20 million years per orbit. So those are a few timescales on the galactic level. On the solar system level, you know, of course, 1 year is the time it takes the Earth to go around the Sun. A very useful number to remember is that a year is about pi times 10 to the 7 seconds. So it's about 31 million seconds. And that saves you from having to multiply 3,600 times 24 times 365 over and over again. You can just go right from years to seconds. So one exercise in time scales is that if the Earth is at 1 AU and takes a year to go around the Sun, how long does it take Pluto to go around the Sun? So one thing you should know or be able to work out quickly is for circular Keplerian orbits, how the orbit period varies with the radius. So geological things that happen on the Earth happen on million or 10 million year time scales. Man has been around for something under 100,000 years, I gather, depending on how you define when man starts. Geologic processes on Earth also take place over thousands of years. And one good thing to keep in mind is, that, for example, fast geologic processes like the flowing of glaciers, glaciers flow on the order of a few feet per year, typically. One interesting thing that I've looked up, and I believe this is true, and I didn't look it up on Wikipedia. The transport of heat from the core of the Earth to the surface of the Earth takes place primarily by convection, not by conduction. So heat transport can take place in general in two ways. If you just imagine like a solid piece of wood, you heat up one side, and microscopically that causes the atoms to rattle around, and the ones closest to the heat source rattle around first, and then their atomic motion is communicated to their neighbors, and so the heat propagates across a piece of wood, sort of at, you know, the heat transport port across a 2-inch slab of wood with a 50 degree centigrade temperature difference, you know, takes on the order of a minute. Through water, it's about the same. However, water, being a liquid, can convect, meaning rather than the heat flowing through the material body, what happens is, since the water is liquid and different parts of the water can move relative to other parts, what happens is convective cells get set up so that the heat is transported by the actual motion of the water. And what I recall is that the transport of heat from the core to the surface of the Earth really happens by the motion of material in the mantle up to the crust. And so that the mantle, which is semi-solid, actually parts of it get hot and rise and then lose their heat when they get to the top where it's cooler, and then are pushed back down by subsequent material. And so the that happens much more, that transports heat more efficiently than by just conduction. The churning of the mantle, which is, as I recall, order 1,000 or 2 kilometers per thick, is sort of 10 million years for one cycle. You should check that, but I think the order of magnitude's about right. So the place where relative time constant, relative transition, just from the course of reading, the power source for reactors is spontaneous fission, and uranium-238 has about a 4 billion year spontaneous fission half life. U-238 is the first element in a long decay chain, which is referred to as the 4N plus 2 decay chain. And if you work on low background experiments or in nuclear physics, you know that U-238 uranium contamination is a frequent problem for these experiments, because the lifetime at 4.5 billion years is so long that any contamination will pose a radiological background problem. And then there's a long subsequent chain of about 15 elements getting down to the stable lead isotope lead-206 with alpha and beta and gamma radiation being emitted. And the 4 billion year half-life is what makes this such a problem. So here's a little problem dealing with timescale. U-238 has a 4 billion year half-life and decays by beta emission to thallium-234, which has a 24-day half-life, and so on down the chain. Suppose you have a lump of U-238. Find and you let it sit for a long time. Number one, find after a long time the relative concentration of U-238 and thallium-234. And number two, define what long is in terms of the relevant time constants of half-life of 4.5 billion years for U-238 and 24.1 days for U-234. This is referred to as secular equilibrium. So if you start with a lump of U-238, after some amount of time, you will find concentrations of all kinds of different things in this decay chain, and the relative concentrations will be determined by the relative half-lives. So work that out. Now, U-238 has a cousin, another uranium isotope, U-235. Those of you who know about bombs and things like that know that U-235 is what you really want. The reason is not that the spontaneous fission lifetime is much shorter, because it isn't. It's 0.7 billion years instead of 4.5 billion years. So it's less than a factor of 10. Although that is nice. What's really important about U-235 is it has a large neutron capture cross-section and turns into U-236, which just kind of is not a naturally occurring isotope and just kind of falls into two pieces. So spits out a bunch of neutrons. So it's really the neutron capture properties of U-235 that are important. U-235 is about less than a percent of naturally occurring uranium. It's about 0.7%. So another isotope you should know about is carbon-14. Carbon-14 has a lifetime of about 5,730 years. And that's important because it's, first of all, it's long-lived in comparison with human time. So we live for about 100 years. And we kind of typically think of a generation of a human generation of about 30 years. So carbon-14's half-life is about 20 generations. So it's very important for establishing the date of things. Also, of course, carbon you find all over in nature. So it's not very difficult to find a carbon component of something you want to establish the date of, for example, a tree or the Shroud of Turin or some oxygen that or some air that's been trapped in the Arctic ice shelf. And the idea is that once the carbon is removed from the influence of cosmic rays and chemical properties and is just isolated on its own, the carbon-14 begins to decay away. And so after, say, 50,000 years, 10 lifetimes, you would not expect to find any carbon-14. So, for example, if you get an ice core from the Antarctic and pull it up and find how much carbon-14 there is, and it's only a fraction of the naturally occurring abundance for that area, then you know that that's been sequestered from the biosphere for some period of time. A third isotope you run into a lot is americium-241. You may not know what this is. This is an alpha emitter. You certainly use it in your laboratory course. It has a lifetime of 432 years, and it's commonly used in smoke detectors. And the way it works is there is a very weak alpha source that is decaying, say, at a few kilohertz, and the alphas, some fraction of them, leave the surface of the alpha source and transit a open region that's just open to the air to a cathode. And that current of alpha particles makes a very small current. And if there's smoke in the air, the alpha particles get absorbed by the smoke. So all the smoke detector does is look for a drop in that current. So here's a little problem. Suppose you want to design a smoke detector, and I tell you that I can give you a circuit that can reliably measure a current that's 1 nanohertz to 10% precision. So step number one, work out what the activity of the source you need, how many decays per second, keeping in mind that only about half of the decays actually leave the source. Number two, you should also keep in mind that alpha particles are doubly charged. They're helium nuclei, so they're charged plus two. So work out how many decays per second you need, and then work out how many grams or micrograms, whatever the appropriate unit is, of americium-241 you need to put in the source to make that current. That actually, I think, would be a pretty good general one question. In the zoo of fundamental particles, there are really four whose lifetimes you just might want to keep in mind. First of all is the neutron. The neutron is a few MeV lighter, heavier than the proton, and decays weakly to a proton and an electron and neutrino. And the neutron lifetime is about 1,000 seconds. And so a good problem would be to use Fermi theory, if you've learned how to do that, to estimate the neutron lifetime. And Fermi theory is really just identical to electromagnetic theory, except you use the Fermi coupling constant instead of the electromagnetic coupling constant. And it's the fact that the Fermi coupling constant is very, very small compared to the electromagnetic coupling constant that makes the neutron so long-lived. The muon is another particle that weakly decays. It's much less massive than the neutron, but the energy difference in the decay, instead of being a few MeV, is hundreds of MeV. It's 105 MeV, in fact, the mass of the muon. The muon decays to an electron and two neutrinos, and the lifetime is 2.2 microseconds. And this is probably something that you're familiar with, because muon decay is something most people run across in their junior lab. Finally, I'll just mention the top quark is the heaviest of the known elementary particles. It has a mass of about 176 GeV and a lifetime of 0.5 times 10 to the minus 25 seconds. That might be 24 seconds, you should check. And the top quark and W boson have about the same, within a factor of two, the same lifetime. The top quark decays to a B quark and a W boson, and the W boson then decays to an electron and neutrino. Typically, for weak decays, there's something called Sargent's rule, which roughly says that lifetimes go like the mass of the decaying particle to the fifth power, which that's true for the cases when the masses of all the particles in the final states are small compared with the mass of the decaying particle. So you might want to just try that out for neutron, muon, and top quark. It really doesn't work very well. You can contrast these lifetimes with the lifetime of the pi zero, which is the neutral pion. The charged pions decay by weak interactions. The pi zero has a lifetime of 8 times 10 to the minus 17 seconds, and that's an electromagnetic decay. A pi zero is a bound state of an up quark and an anti-up quark. Actually, it's a superposition of up quark, anti-up quark, down quark, anti-down quark. And they annihilate to a couple of photons. So pi zero decays to two photons. That lifetime is 10 to the minus 17 seconds. You can compare that with the lifetime of the muon, which is 2.2 microseconds, or the lifetime of the charged pions, which are also weakly decay. Pi plus decays to a pi zero. Pi plus decays to a muon and a neutrino, and as I recall, that lifetime is about 26 nanoseconds. So the electromagnetic decay is just much, much faster because the electromagnetic coupling constant at these energies is much larger than the weak coupling constant. One thing you should know all about is hydrogen, and we'll probably have a special podcast just about properties of hydrogen. The sort of ore transition, one that you can actually calculate, is the 2p to 1s transition. This is the allowed transition, the sort of the simplest allowed transition, and it has a lifetime of about 1.5 or 2 nanoseconds. And a good exercise is to just sit down and calculate it, just work it out. Now, selection rules are really important in atomic transitions, and you know that there's a selection rule that says that you want the angular momentum of the atomic state to change by 1 unit. So if you compare the 1.6 nanoseconds for the 2p to 1s transition with the 2s to 1s transition, what you find is the 2s to 1s transition is 14 orders of magnitude slower. So 2s to 1s is 4 times 10 to the 5 seconds, so 40,000 seconds. A good exercise, and maybe we'll talk about this in a subsequent podcast, is to try to explain that by working out what operator you need for the 2s to 1s transition and calculating the suppression factor. What you should remember is that when you calculate the transition in the dipole, well, you use an expansion of the electromagnetic field. So what you do is you expand e to the I kx. And so the first couple terms of that expansion are 1, and then there's a term that's I kx, and that's the one for the allowed dipole transition. So in the matrix element, you have the bra for the 2p, then there's the x, which is the operator, and then there's the ket, which is 1s. The next term is k squared plus x squared, and so on. So it would be interesting, just as an exercise, to see if you can work out why that suppression factor is like 14 orders of magnitude. Also, with the hydrogen atom, there's the very famous 21-centimeter line. This has a frequency of 1420 megahertz and is really important cosmologically because it's so long-lived. It's about 3 times 10 to the 14 seconds. And what it is a spin-flip transition. So the excited state of hydrogen, of neutral hydrogen in its atomic ground state, is with the proton and electron spins both pointing in the same direction. There's no orbital angular momentum because it's a 1s state. And then the transition goes ahead by a spin flip from parallel, which is the higher energy state, to anti-parallel. So some good things to work out is, first of all, try to calculate the energy difference between those two states. And second, see if you can figure out what operator mediates that transition. I think it's a magnetic quadrupole operator. I'll check it for when we do hydrogen atom. That lifetime is really important because it means that this transition is very, very slow. And it's really nice because there's a lot of hydrogen in the interstellar medium and in galaxies. And you have this nice, slow microwave transition that you can easily detect and use this for mapping out galaxies. The long lifetime is, of course, compensated by the fact that there's a great deal of hydrogen along any column that you look at with a radio telescope. So another interesting problem to work out is sort of the fundamental speed of computing. The speed of computing is dictated by how long it takes an electron to cross a gate in, for example, a CMOS type transistor to go from source to drain. So you know the way a CMOS transistor works, there is a line coming in. This is all done in silicon, so there's a line coming in and a line going out, and there's a little gap between them. And there's an insulating layer over that gap, and then there's another conductor on top of the insulator called the gate. And depending on whether there's a voltage on the gate or not, there's a conducting channel between the gap and across the gap between the source and the drain. And this allows one current or one voltage, the voltage applied to the gate, to control the current flowing between the source and drain. And that's a fundamental computing element. And the fundamental limit of how fast a computer can operate is simply dictated by how fast that gate opens and closes, and how fast carriers can migrate across the gate. Both of those things depend on the feature size, which is basically how large you can make the gate, and how small you can make the gate, and how small you can make the gap in between the source and the drain. So, as you probably learned in your condensed matter physics course, there are two carriers in silicon in a semiconductor, electrons and places where there aren't electrons, which are called holes. And the way these things move around is fundamentally diffusive, but can be characterized by a mobility. And the mobility depends on the electric field. So let's see if we can just put some numbers together. The mobility also depends on the carrier concentration. So let's say typically up to carrier concentrations of about 10 to the 16th carriers per cubic centimeter, you can think of the holes and electrons as non-interacting gases. At higher concentrations, they begin to interact with each other more and more, and the mobility goes down. So the electron mobility in silicon is 1,400, and this is in units of centimeter squared volt seconds. Centimeters squared volts per second. And the holes move about a third as fast. So work out the following things. What's the transit time for electrons if you're using, say, 3 volts across a gate that's 1 micron across? And 1 micron, I think, is kind of near the cutting edge of feature sizes these days. How quickly does that electron get across that? And try to convert that to how fast you can open and close the gate. Now, you'll come up with some number, some time for opening and closing the gate. Take the reciprocal of that and convert that to a frequency, meaning how many gate openings and closings there are per second. And compare that with the frequency or the clock speed of whatever computer you're sitting in front of. So it's kind of interesting to think of the things that really limit the speed of your computer is how small you can make the gate, the less distance the electrons have to go, the faster they get there. The velocity is what you need really to calculate, and that depends on the mobility divided by the electric potential. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. That's the mobility times the electric field. So the larger the electric field, the faster the mobility. And finally, the mobility depends on the material. And I think, for example, germanium, for typical concentrations, the mobilities are somewhat higher than in silicon. And then there are some stranger things like gallium arsenide, which are even faster. Just for fun, you might want to go look these up and compare them and try to think about what the real issues are in making faster computers so that you can execute more instructions, so that Microsoft Word can have even more features that you don't understand how to use. Incidentally, the really important property of superconductors is not that they don't dissipate heat. Nobody cares, really, to first order, how much heat your computer dissipates. My MacBook dissipates plenty of heat, and they're just a big old fan. What really matters is the switching time, and that's very, very fast in superconductors. It's remember, superconductors, everything in the switching channel is one quantum mechanical state, and you should think about how you could estimate the switching time from that being one state to another state. So there's been a number of interesting things. This has kind of been a rich couple of weeks. A couple of issues of Science ago, let's see, this is the November 10th issue, there was a little article reporting that these guys at Duke had actually built the microwave cloaking device. I think I reported on this in the third or fourth podcast, and these guys have actually gone and built one. It only works in two dimensions, and the cloak itself actually looks quite complicated and is made out of micro-machined things. But it's interesting to look at. The November 17th issue of Science has a pretty interesting article on money. And let me just see if I can find the title of it. Money is Material. Oh, that was the... Sorry, just a second. The title is actually The Psychological Consequences of Money. And these people did about eight different experiments. Just doing things like having someone filling out a bogus questionnaire sitting in a room, and in front of them there was either a poster of money of various denominations, or a poster of a South Sea Island, or a poster of leaves. And then someone would come into the room with a big box of pencils and drop the pencils accidentally on the floor. And what they found out is that typically people who were looking at money and thinking about money were less helpful picking up the pencils than people who weren't looking at money. There were a bunch of experiments like this. They also found if they did the same thing and had the people filling out questionnaires about what they like to do on vacations, that the people would tend to choose more solitary vacations where they were alone than people who were looking at other pictures and presumably thinking about other things. It's kind of interesting to read this article because it's all it's all these really kind of strange ways they have of getting people to think about money without just telling them think about money. So it's kind of good to look through. Physics Today, the November issue, has kind of this really odd article on putting telescopes on the moon. It really didn't quite make sense to me. I have actually very strong opinions about manned spaceflight and NASA. I think manned spaceflight's great. But I think it's really important to have some more coherent strategy for what NASA should be doing, and I think you just think about Hubble and you think about everything that's come out of Hubble, and maybe if they work really really hard they can get the next version, the Webb Space Telescope, up and running, and you know, kind of at this point thinking about putting something on the moon is a little bit odd. Finally, there was a really kind of nice piece in Nature, and this is the November 16th edition, about understanding accretion disks. And this is something I'd never appreciated until I read the perspective. The problem is this: you have a black hole, and there's all this stuff falling into the black hole, and you know, people like Deepu Chakrabarty and people who spend their time looking at X-rays, you know, can see and measure the density and the flow into the black hole. But the problem is if you work out how the accretion, the accreting material gets rid of angular momentum, the viscosity is much, much too low. The Reynolds number of these flows is huge. It's millions. And the Reynolds number is the ratio of the characteristic momentum to the characteristic diffusion of momentum or viscosity. So a large Reynolds number means low viscosity. So nobody's quite sure for a long time of how these things got rid of their angular momentum. And there were some simulations that really indicated that the way they get rid of angular momentum is through coupling to a magnetic field. So there were some simulations or calculations or whatever that sort of explained it in terms of this magnetic model. But, you know, nobody really knows what's going on these things. So these guys at Princeton built this little simulator to simulate the, it's called Taylor-Couette flow, which is the kind of flow you get between two concentric cylinders that are rotating differently. And they actually did very, very careful measurements of the angular momentum transport, and in fact verified that even in the turbulent regimes, there wasn't enough angular momentum transmitted to account for the loss of angular momentum necessary for the accretion disk to fall into the black hole. So they sort of conclude with that it's probably some magnetic phenomenon. But the neat thing is they built this really complicated thing, and now they can put it in a big magnetic field, and they can fill it with liquid gallium, which somehow models what they're really after. I just think this is a really neat experiment, and I'm really kind of impressed at the diligence of these guys actually putting all this thing together. So that's it for this week. If you have any questions, whether or not you're from MIT, please feel free to email. My address is fisherp@mit.edu. We have a new website. I'm not sure who's using it. It's scripts.mit.edu/podcast/WordPress. And it's got some other stuff on it, and it's kind of a nice looking web page. We're going to try to distribute this through iTunes. We're just past the halfway part, and it's really kind of interesting to think of how many different things we've talked about, and how much time you've actually spent, even if you're doing the half hour a day scheme. So keep at it. If you've really been working a little bit each day all this time, you've put in a lot of time. I don't know if I've mentioned this before. A big part of reducing stress is to make things expected. David Allen calls this cranking widgets. And his idea is that you plan things and kind of reduce it to, you know, cranking widgets. And cranking a widget just means that you've got some little thing and you turn a handle, and some known results comes out. And cranking widgets is not boring. In fact, it's kind of delightful because you know what's happening, and it's kind of stress-free. For many of us, writing computer code is cranking a widget. It's just really pretty easy, doesn't require a lot of challenging thought. So hopefully, if you're just cranking away at this little widget a half hour a day, you should be in pretty good shape. And as I've mentioned, you can start thinking about ramping it up to 45 minutes a day, or just adding a book to read. And I've recommended Papard. Purcell's a great book to read if you want to review electricity and magnetism. I'll try to find a good quantum mechanics book to recommend. There really kind of isn't one that's readable. I'll give it some thought. Anyway, I'd like to thank, as always, Sheila Holzer Marston and her husband John, and Homer Reed and Bonna from REFS, and Alex Hamilton from Columbia for inspiration. And I also on the new website, I can see how many people are downloading. So it's kind of nice to see that there are actually people downloading this and listening to it, which until this week I did not know. So I was really going head on faith. So maybe this is just people poking around. The website doesn't tell me that. Anyway, have a good week, and I hope you had a good Easter holiday. I know I did. And enjoy your work and research wherever you are. And I'll see you next week.